At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
For approximately the one zillionth time on this program, economic credit is given where economic credit is due. You go, American consumer, you go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 16th day of November. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. There is a little bounce in the step of the American economy today, and all y'all can go right ahead and pat yourselves on the back. Said the Census Bureau this morning, retail sales for October came in way better than expected, up 1.7% from September, on top of big gains in July and August. And we're spending everywhere. Electronics, home and garden, online, gas stations too. But that last one, a 4% month-on-month increase in spending at gas stations, hints at something that's really important to understand about this big surge in retail sales. They're up, sales are sure, but so too are prices. And those two things, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports to get us going, are connected.
I started this morning at my regular gas station. Went inside to pay.
Wow, $4.19 a gallon.
It cost me about $1.50 more to fill up my tank today than last month. So in terms of retail sales, I didn't buy more. I just paid more for it. And this dynamic is driving about half the increase in retail sales right now, because retail sales are reported in nominal dollars, which doesn't account for the effect of rising prices on those sales numbers. This hasn't been a big issue until recently, says Michael Pierce at Capital Economics.
Goods prices for a long time were basically stable. So we didn't really have to think too much about how inflation affected these numbers month to month. But obviously now we're seeing pretty extreme price gains. So yeah, once you adjust in real terms, it's not as good as it looks.
Just a 0.8% increase in real retail sales last month, which is still pretty darn good, says supply chain analyst Britton Ladd. He doesn't bother adjusting for price increases.
I look at it, what is the consumer's behavior showing? Are we still seeing a trend of consumers being willing to go out and spend?
And we have been willing, in spite of rising prices. Retail analyst Natalie Cutler at BDO says consumers know supply chains are messed up, products are delayed, and the holidays are coming, so many are shopping early, grabbing what they can, even if it's more expensive. But
the consumer's wallet is not infinite. Prices can go up only so much until the consumer says, enough is enough.
She predicts a pullback from the recent surge in retail sales once the holidays are behind us. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
$4.79 for me at my corner shell station. On Wall Street today, a little bounce in traders' steps, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Been a little bit more than a month now since the backlog of container ships off the coast of Southern California got bad enough to get the Biden administration involved in local port operations. You remember that 24/7 announcement? As of yesterday afternoon, though, the queue was still 83 ships deep, which is one reason somebody tweeted at me the other day, "Kai Rizdahl, you're really missing an opportunity to have an expert in queuing theory wax intellectual about the supply chain and the years it will take to untangle it without massive effort." And I said, "Queuing theory?"
Queuing theory is basically used to predict the expected behavior of any system where things arrive, they get serviced, and then they leave.
Keely Croxton is a professor of logistics at Ohio State.
So for you and me in our everyday lives, we can think of places like walking into the grocery store or a doctor's office or a restaurant. And if we have data, we can use some fancy math to predict how long the line will get. And for example, if I want to figure out how many cashiers I need at the grocery store, I can use queuing theory as a way to mathematically calculate the number of cashiers that I would want to keep my lines at an acceptable level.
When people first started studying lines, which is fundamentally what this is, what did they learn? Was there like an aha moment?
I think for me, at least, my aha moments when I was learning all this stuff is the role of variability in all of this. When things are operating close to an average, queues don't develop and utilization rates are fine. The example I give to my students is if you want to set up an ATM machine and on average, someone's arriving every 3 minutes and the average processing time is 2.5 minutes, yeah, it would seem like there shouldn't be any waiting, right? Because right, your processing time is less than your arrival time. But the problem is that there's variability in that. And we've all been behind that person at the ATM machine that
yes,
fumbles for their card and yes, needs to look up their PIN and wants to do 5 different transactions. It's the variability that really starts to drive lines.
Yeah, setting aside for a second the fact that I'm always behind the guy who's refinancing his mortgage at the ATM machine, it seems to me that it's a single node problem, right?
Yeah.
You know where I'm going. Global supply is a bajillion node problem. So how can we think about it in terms of queuing theory?
Yeah, well, we can extend queuing theory to think about, for example, the port. Essentially, you know, think of it as a cashier at the grocery store. These ships arrive, they need to be processed, and then they leave. And so we can use queuing system to make the same kinds of predictions about what capacity we need or how long the ships will have to wait. But you're right, it's not just what happens at the port. These supply chains are really long. And so when you've got things happening all along that supply chain, that's creating this variability that I think is part of the problem.
How important is it, just on that variability thing, how important is it, not to have some slack, I guess, but let's flip that over, right? How important is it to be able to adapt when systems are running at close to full capacity before they get stressed? Like, I imagine our port operations in this country were running pretty close to capacity before the pandemic, and now they've got this huge burst that they can't handle. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, so the thing about that we can learn from queuing theory is exactly what you were just suggesting, that the higher the average utilization rate of our system, the longer the wait times and the more brittle the system is. These ports were already working pretty close to full utilization, which just makes them unable to handle not only the change in variability of the processing time, but also a sharp increase in simply the arrival rate.
Right.
Retail demand is up something like 30% over 2019, and there's 20% more ships arriving at these ports. And it just is really creating a system that's just designed to be to snap.
One of the things I've been saying when people ask me, Kai, what's going on? How much longer is this going to take? I say, look, the more backed up it gets, the more backed up it's going to get, right? Because there's a finite output from the port, no matter how many ships you get in there. So I'm going to turn it around to you, the professional, and say, how much longer is this going to last?
Well, I mean, the good news is they're starting to see some relief. I just saw a report that there's more capacity downstream from the port, so the container's leaving. But we got the Christmas rush coming in, and so it is going to take certainly through the holidays, and I think well into 2022, maybe even the end of 2022, before we see a return to what most of us in the field would think of as normal supply chain operations. Hmm. When retail demand is up 30%, we're just asking a lot of this very constrained system.
Professor Keely Croxton, she's a professor of logistics at Ohio State. Professor, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Pleasure to talk to you.
President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping talked for 3.5 or so hours last night, long for a video conference, as I think we all can appreciate better now than we did a year and a half ago. Lots of ground was covered, of course, including trade. Specifically, says the White House, President Biden underscoring to his counterpart the importance of China keeping its commitments to buy billions of dollars worth of American goods and services by the end of this year. That was the phase one deal that President Trump negotiated. So, question has to be then, how's Beijing doing on that anyway? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganzer has the answer.
China has promised to buy more agricultural products like soybeans, also U.S. manufactured goods like planes, plus natural gas, oil, and coal. This is all part of the Phase One deal, a trade agreement China signed last year with the Trump administration. So, how's it going?
Well, unfortunately, China hasn't gotten all that close.
Chad Bown is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says the trade deal is 80% goods and about 20% services, and China's on the hook to buy more than $350 billion worth of American products.
It's at this stage running about 40% short, at least on the goods side.
That could be because the goals for Chinese purchases set by the Trump administration were unrealistic. That's what Jennifer Hillman thinks. She's a former U.S. trade negotiator, now at the Council on Foreign Relations. Hillman says, for example, the agreement requires China to boost its imports of natural gas from the U.S. by more than 400%.
We did not have the capacity or the ability to increase shipments up to the level that was set forth in this Phase One agreement.
Another problem, Hillman says, there are still Chinese tariffs on some of the American products Beijing is supposed to buy, making them more expensive. As far as the U.S. services China is committed to using, the pandemic got in the way. Wendy Cutler is another former trade negotiator. She's now vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute.
There's less travel, less tourism, fewer students coming to the United States.
Cutler says the Biden administration should just give Beijing more time to reach the targets in the trade agreement and shouldn't risk another trade war by raising tariffs on Chinese products. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I was having dinner and my neighbor called.
Wait, then what happened? All right, first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 54 points today, a 10th percent, 36,142. The NASDAQ lifted 120.7 tenths percent, 15,973. The S&P 500 found 18 points, nearly 4 tenths percent, 4,700 on the nose. Heard from Mitchell Hartman about retail sales, looking at some retail therapy stocks. Gap rose almost 9 tenths of 1%. Wayfair glowed up 5 8 tenths percent today. Best Buy scored 1.9%. Heard from Nancy Marshall-Genzer about the U.S. reminding China it's due to buy billions of dollars worth of stuff. So, related stocks, Archer Daniels Midland lost 2 tenths percent. Boeing dipped 3 1/10%. Marathon Oil up about 1/10%. Fair warning on this one, holiday turkeys are in especially short supply. You had to know this was coming. Frozen turkey inventory is 24% below 3-year average volumes. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. By now, I guess. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-notes, up to 1.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The flip side of that pretty strong retail sales report Mitchell was talking about to get us going is that consumers spending more means retailers are doing a lot more business. And normally that's a good thing, but normal is not what these times are. Case in point, this dispatch from one of our retailer regulars about how she's staffing up for the holidays one way or the other.
This is Kristen Tallheimer Bingham. I am co-owner of Dean Sweets Chocolatier in Portland, Maine. We don't have any job openings right now. I am very happy to say if we were shorthanded at this time in the year, we'd be in really big trouble. We do have a few spots in our schedule where we could still use some more help, but our plan is to fill those spots with just working longer hours. We have also hired a few people on a temporary basis to work on large orders, and Dean and I pretty much pick up anything that's necessary. You know, it's our business, and of course, if we need to work till midnight, that's what we do. It's not terribly unusual in the crunch situation that happens this time of year.
That was Kristen Tallheimer Bingham there, burning the midnight oil, as one of the co-owners of Dean Sweets in Portland, Maine. Way down deep in the October jobs report, the one that came out just a couple of weeks ago, was a nugget about remote work, or in the federal government's now quaint lexicon, telework. The share of workers staying out of the office because they're worried about the virus fell last month after plateauing over the summer. It hit a pandemic low of 11.6%. However, more workers may well be going back into the office, but they are not necessarily going back to downtown business districts. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
No, cities aren't dead, as it seemed early in the pandemic, but those high-rise office towers that make their skylines aren't too popular these days.
No doubt about it, downtowns are taking the brunt of this.
Especially in the biggest cities, says Ian Anderson at commercial real estate firm CBRE. Office vacancies are up everywhere, but they've gone up much faster in downtowns than in the suburbs, where commutes aren't as painful.
It's a little more accessible, it's lower density, and it's easier.
It's a big turnaround from the years before the pandemic, says Ellen Dunham Jones at Georgia Tech.
We saw this big move of big office folks moving back into the cities. Plus, that's where the new younger digital savvy workers all wanted to live in cities.
The pandemic reversed some of the trend toward urbanization. Families are seeking more space in the suburbs. But young people are returning to cities like New York and San Francisco, says Robert Salmon with Cushman Wakefield.
Those people renting apartments realize they're going to have to go back into the office at least a few days a week, and they may as well be convenient for them to do so.
But even if remote work brings fewer office jobs back to central business districts, that doesn't have to spell disaster, says Richard Florida, author of The Creative Class.
You know, cities used to have these giant factory complexes and warehouse complexes, but some of them have been repurposed.
And he says perhaps that same process of repurposing could turn today's ill-used offices into tomorrow's vibrant arts district. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
For more than a year, Amy Scott, who covers housing for us, has been reporting on the progress being made on a single block in Baltimore as a group of women renovate empty houses to turn them into affordable housing. That project's been led by a carpenter named Shelley Halstead and the nonprofit she founded, Black Women Build Baltimore. Shelley's been tipping her toe into some for-profit development in the neighborhood, too, though. Here's Amy.
Back in July, Shelley took a break from building and went to visit a close friend in the Caribbean. She was just starting to unwind when one night...
I was having dinner and my neighbor called, and I thought, that's kind of late for her to call. So I declined the call, and then another neighbor called, and that's when you have that sinking feeling that something isn't okay.
This time, she picked up. It was her friend Albert.
And he said, your building's on fire.
Her building, a three-story abandoned building she'd refinanced her mortgage to buy for $110,000 just a few months before. She planned to turn it into lofts and a gallery for Black artists. Back home in Baltimore, a friend started filming. In the video, you can see more than a dozen firefighters battling the flames as neighbors watch from the street.
And then they kept texting photos and video of the building on fire. And I'm just sort of freaking out.
She cut off her vacation, booked the first flight she could find, and came home.
Just watch here. I don't know if there's nails or whatever. Okay.
Later, we meet outside in the late summer heat, and Shelley shows me the damage. She removes the screws from a sheet of plywood she'd put up to keep out trespassers and pulls it back.
Oh, my God.
Inside the shell of a building, there's nothing but a pile of scorched beams on the floor, the remains of the fallen roof. While the brick walls still stand, anything made of wood, the window frames and flooring, is charred black.
That's where it started, up in that corner. That's what the fire person said.
As to how it started, the official report said undetermined. But Shelley couldn't shake the feeling that it was intentional.
It felt targeted. It felt targeted to slow me down.
This isn't the only building Shelley is developing in Upton, a historic but distressed neighborhood in West Baltimore. She also has plans for a cafe a block over, plus her nonprofit work rehabbing houses for affordable home ownership. As a relative newcomer from Seattle, she's faced some resentment from power brokers, who she says had their own designs on the building. A few days after the fire, she was voted off the community association board.
I have to believe that it was a squatter that set it on fire, because if not, then the alternative is to believe that somebody intentionally did this and is trying to really mess with me.
Shelley has another reason to be suspicious. There'd been a huge rainstorm that day. The part of the building where the fire started was exposed to the elements.
a fire breaking out in the building that's been sitting there for 20 years in a rainstorm, that's a lot of wet wood.
That's Andre Robinson, a community developer who's worked in Baltimore and D.C. He used to live in Upton and had made an offer for the same building. He says he's seen this dynamic in distressed neighborhoods before.
When you have a society that's been sort of wrecked to a certain extent, fiefdoms will pop up in the midst of all that. Baltimore's no different. And if you, the stranger, are coming in and talking anything different and aren't falling in line with what they're talking about, you kind of become a target. But the bottom line is that she'll still win.
It's going to cost her. The building had been too unstable to insure. Shelley figures the fire set her back about $100,000. And it isn't the only setback she's faced. Earlier this year, several tools went missing from the houses she's been rebuilding on Edding Street. Someone tipped her off that people were taking them around the corner to sell.
So I got my shop vac back, but they took like a table saw, a couple chop saws, drill motors. You'll be like, where's the... Really? You took that? We put in heated floors. They took the thermostats.
All that just slows things down. I started out this series asking, why can't Baltimore solve its vacancy crisis? The official count, more than 15,000 buildings with a vacancy notice, has stayed stubbornly high for the past decade. And this is one reason. There are so many forces working against developers like Shelley, sometimes even their own neighbors. After the fire, she wondered why she's even doing this.
You know, I was sort of like, is it worth it? Right? Like, is this worth it? But then, as a builder who just sees the possibility in everything around here, just absolutely everything, I'm like, yeah, it's worth it.
So she'll keep going until it's not worth it. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am not entirely sure that United Airlines has thought this all the way through. CNN is reporting the carrier has started serving hard liquor again as of yesterday, ahead of the always calm and never overcrowded and stressful holiday travel season. Beer, wine, and hard seltzer have already been on offer since June, as have increased incidents of passenger misbehavior, unruliness, and violence. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, Saturday's News Today edition. When asked when he was going to clue the rest of us in about who he's going to choose to chair the Federal Reserve, President Biden said today he hoped to make a final decision in about 4 days. That's a quote. About which two things? Number one, come on, he's already decided, right? Number two, Saturday? That's when he's going to tell us? Saturday? Seriously? All right, we're leaving. Our digital and on Saturday? Digital and on demand. Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.